No, I've been preoccupied with it's actually more sort of engineering, really. The whole thing of trying to fit a lot of things into a small space. But I've always been fascinated by firstly demountable housing. Once my uncle once, when I was about 16, he bought an A-framed beach house in a kit. It just came in a it came on a truck, and all the timbers were numbered, and he and I, between us, and he wasn't an extremely capable man, between us we put this A-framed house together.
Who is it?
My uncle.
Oh, your uncle, okay.
Yeah, my father's brother. But I think most people, especially the English in particular, are fascinated by caravans and the sort of ingenuity that's required to live in a tiny space. And I love boat cabins. You know, anything that, you know, sort of where the bed folds into the wall and the cupboard slides out. And then my, see, I had the fortune to have a Buckminster Fuller as a teacher when I was a student.
Actually, in person.
Yeah. He turned up at the university where I was when I was a young student. And actually, it was due to him that I'm not now a rich and successful architect, because he convinced me and quite a few other people in the university that the whole thing was what he called a neo-Egyptian anachronism. It was consuming some of the most creative individuals on the planet to indulge in, you know, a terrible. Because you know, he's saying simultaneous with this sort of wheelbarrows full of bricks and concrete that go into housing is just sort of alloyed aeroplanes and you know, high tech sort of technology that doesn't acknowledge. So his main concern, or one of his main concerns, was how much a building weighs. You know, because he's a, I mean, he coming from, because he was by no means an architect. He was I don't know what he was. You know, he was uncategorizable, because he was just a very clear-thinking individual who, it was, you know, he had this thing that man is a problem-solving device, and so he loved solving problems. And he first made. He also had this preoccupation with what he called Dymaxian structures, which are structures where you have a central compression unit, and then everything else is held together with tension. You know, like his theory was that the universe, because in the universe, he called it, I'll think of it in a minute, but because in the universe you've got balls of compression, like your planets and things are balls of compression, and a ball, like a roller bearing, is the most efficient form of a compressive. And like a ball bearing, it can take a massive amount of compression. So your compressive forces are generally spherical, ideally spherical, and your tensile forces are linear. That the structure of our universe is spherical compressed balls and long linear strands that join them up, and the compression, the gravitational forces that hold the universe together. The compressive forces are spherical, and the tensile forces are linear, and the compressive forces are separate or discontinuous, and the tensile forces are continuous. And so he called that tensegrity. And he, based on tensegrity, he built tensegrity structures. So he built in 1936 or something, he designed a house which had a central aluminium mast, and then off the top of that were these stainless steel cables that then held together a hexagonal, like rim, like a bicycle rim, and then the walls hung from that, and then your floor was another rim that went round, and so you had these two compressive rings, all wound together by a threaded together by a long stainless steel wire. And you see, whereas if you look at conventional construction, it doesn't use tension at all; it's all compressive. So there's no and the combination, except that, I mean, if you look at concrete, for instance, it's a pretty good combination of tension and compression, because concrete is compressive, and the steel in your concrete is tensile. So concrete is in his terms is synergetic, but that's Neo-Egyptian tensegrity, whereas it's like an aeroplane or a bicycle wheel is sort of high tech tensegrity. Anyhow, so there he was in 1936, developing an assemblable kit house, but with this quite unique structural thing, which never, I mean, I don't think one even got built. He just built models of it and stuff. Whereas in 1945, at the end of the Second World War, there was a huge housing shortage for returned soldiers and stuff, apparently. And so they had a big competition in America to come up with what they called deployable housing, which was going to be a housing that they built somewhere and you delivered by helicopter. So you could order a house, and his house in that competition, which they built a few, but due to all sorts of complications, never went ahead. It was just too far out, you know. It was round. It was aluminium. It was crimped aluminium sheet, like corrugated aluminium sheet, but square crimped aluminium sheet, around, and it had all your storage was in the thickness of your wall, so your storage was your insulation, and all your cupboards and things were conveyor belted. So you opened a cupboard and pushed a button, and your sort of bath towels came along, you know, and your thing. He had actually in the Dymaxion house, the first one in 1936, he first developed, but by the time he did the second one, which I think he called the Wichita houses, he had what was called a die-cast bathroom. And die-cast means you stamp out major sheet metal things, and he had a die-cast bathroom, so you had a toilet and a shower in a single unit that was stamped together from stainless steel, like these toilets on trains and stuff, you know, a bit like that. But this one recycled its shower waters in 1945. It was recycling its shower water. And so it was sort of a very ingenious small house in 1945. And so, like I say, he was a very strong influence on me as a young student, not only for his practical inventions, but also he had a very clear set of geometric ideas and geometric principles and what you might call geometric insights into the planet. I won't rave about Buckminster Fuller, but I'll just say he was, because of that, he just fitted into my already existing obsession with actually trying to fit things together in an ingenious and small way. And then when I came here, in fact, the capsule, of which we must have built, I reckon, over the years, about 500, you know, the first capsules, I mean, I was bringing a bullet cart load of bamboo and keet and stuff out of Pondicherry a week, a bullet cart a week, for about up to 10 years, you know, from 1975, I suppose, when we first started building capsules, till about 1985, and still we built capsules occasionally. But the capsule began as a portable toilet, you know. I don't know if you remember when we began, we just dug tree holes, and we had a structure that you put over the top of the tree hole, and you filled it up with dead leaves and dung, personally generated dung. And when it was full, you picked up the structure and moved on. And in the beginning, the first one was just a square platform with a sort of a shoulder-high screen around, because nobody was too concerned about privacy. But then gradually the women in the community asked me to design something that was a bit more private, and the children too, you know, as the children got older. And so we built the first, together with Ramu, who was this wizard from Burma Pallium, who I was like this kindred spirit that I found in Burma Pallium, was this wonderful little man who's now dead, Ramu. I don't remember Ramu. But he was just a super little guy who had with him three or four other men who were also... I mean, the existing... All villages had their own house-building team, and he was just a Burma Pallium house-building team, really. Yeah, so then once I hooked up with Ramu, like Ramu is one of those guys who you could wave your arm and come back an hour later or 2 hours later, and not only had he done, he'd surpassed what you'd expected him to do, you know. He was just a wizard. He was an extraordinary man, Ramu. And so between he and I and his little construction team, so when I first came here, we used to, once I discovered Ramu, I should just set out every morning with a tiffin and work with him day all day, you know, building. It was such fun, climb, because if you're, you know, you're so hampered by traditional architecture, conventional architecture, if you're stuck in that concrete bloody jungle, you know, that when you get here and you can work in the open air yourself, tying ropes and bamboo and casual, because bamboo was much more available then than it is now. I've always been... Look, the capsules, and the good thing about the capsules even were modular. You know, we used to had, I mean, we built once in Ami, I don't remember, in Ami, Ami once was a capsule community. Mm-hmm. There were like 20 capsules, and in the middle I had a capsule castle, which was three capsules around a thing with a capsule in the air. And it was this, with a hollow in the middle. And so it was a, and that for me, that was a ideal sort of one person, you know, living unit. And like I say, there was, everyone lived in capsules, you know, those days.
Yeah, I remember when I came, the first time I lived in a capsule.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Coolest place I ever lived.
Yeah. Great, yeah. But times have shifted, you know, and people have changed, really, you know, when you consider it, you know, because now if like, for instance, my son, Jesse, he, you know, if I'm designing for him, he wants what he calls sort of alternative luxury. The thing is that these days, what kids consider to be the minimum, really, is mosquito-proof, dust-proof. Dust is an essential thing, isn't it? You know, if you have any, like here, for instance, if you have any contact with computers and iPods and things, you don't want dust, you know. Yeah. You don't want mold in monsoon. You don't want ants in your computer. You know, you don't, like, computers have definitely shifted the whole standard of housing. The same as television did to the village housing. You know, like village housing, remember, was all around a courtyard, but because you can't watch a television set in a courtyard house, the houses became
different.
Single mono block rooms. We go to the village houses. Remember going into village houses and trying to watch television sitting in a corridor like this, looking sideways.
Let's come back to the nanopod now. Suddenly that evolved to this nanopod, which is temporary. You can pick it up and move it, and it's
well, you can't. Yeah, you can't physically pick it up and move it. Now, like the capsule, we used to pick up and move, and in those days there was so little traffic on the roads, we used to be able to put them on bullet carts and move them around. But the nanopod, for the answer then is to have demountable. You know, where you can take it apart.
Uh-huh.
And move it.
A Lego house.
Yeah. Type thing. Yeah. I think Safram had that same idea years ago with his Lego.
Mm-hmm.
Which is even basically the same design, I think. It's like a cruciform, what you call a cruciform. It's a cross with projecting wings, sort of thing. And the only real difference is, well, one fundamental difference is its relationship to the ground and consequently to termites, you know, because it's been my experience that everything I've ever built years ago or anything, I mean, even like most of the houses in Certitude, for instance, have trouble with termites, you know, like they know, you know, they've got Orison's home, they've got termites in their door frames on the second floor. Everybody's got termites. And you'd be surprised how most people are getting termite contractors to come in and dig a channel around their house and pour in the most incredible toxic poisons that nobody knows about. This is what, I won't mention any names, but quite a few people have had to do. And so, and Australia has the same problem with termites. And so also in tropical Australia, everything is off the ground, up on stilts. It's either high enough to park your car underneath, you know, which a lot of people have a shed underneath, or, you know, park your car in a garage in a workshop, and different things. Or it's like this. It's a meter off the ground, which, as I always find, is a pleasant relationship to have to the ground. You know, to be just a little bit higher than it. And it means that your hottest air, which is at ground level, you know, which is just coming off the ground, your hottest air is blowing away,
mm-hmm.
And you're in a better situation to have a naturally cooled house, because
mm-hmm.
That's the sort of idea. So the first model of the nanopod actually I built years ago in bricks and mortar for my daughter Gina. And that exists in Fertile. And then I modified that. Then Paul and I built one from Keat, and it had concrete pillars and a Keat roof and a mud floor.
This one you've got over here is not a meter, though, is it? It's not a meter off the
Off the ground? No, it's a bit less than a meter off the ground. It's got to be big enough to crawl under, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to be, not because it's good to be able to crawl under your house if you've got wiring and piping, and say you want to store batteries under there for solar panels and things. Like, see what Julia does, she has stacks of wood under the house and different things, but she keeps her ladder under the house and stuff. And then, so, I don't know, I mean, then, like I say, Paul and I built one, and it was predominantly wood and mud. Also, imagine a situation where you've got in the youth centre, you know, sets of these pods, where kids can live in them or take them with them if they want, if they personalise them, you know, like, you know, I don't know, if they paint them or they decorate them or they do things inside that they want to. Could you do in the, you know, in the selection of materials and different things, you can have a personal building.
Do you see this as a possibility for the problem of newcomer housing, though?
Well, it would definitely break the thing. Like, I don't know if you read the thing in Oroville today from the housing development, where they said now, have you investigated the possibility of introducing one or two houses into existing communities as a way of increasing? And they said, I've forgotten who it was from the housing group, said, oh yes, there's absolutely no possibility of any of the communities in Oroville allowing anybody else in. Everybody told us, nobody very vehemently, no. Whereas if it's a question of a small demandable house that you can put there and say eventually, look, if it doesn't work out, you can move it, you know, like the thing of permanence becomes an issue, you know. And I know the same thing from a community, you know. If you've got like somebody there, you would like to say to them, look, let's try a 3 months trial period, you know, sort of thing, and see how that works out. And if it doesn't work out, then you're free to move your house somewhere else, sort of thing. And so it's a good way. So and as a first stepping stone to something bigger, it's definitely a totally minimal house, you know. I can't imagine, you know, somebody telling me they reckon they could live in it with two adults and two children, you know. I was saying, well, you'd be like living in a cupboard, you know. But they say, okay, when you're your first house in Oroville, maybe, like people like that used to live, like Klaus and Ingrid lived in a capsule with, first with Barmer, and then I think with Ananda before they built another house, you know. That was a capsule that got blown over in a cyclone. But, yeah, I mean, sort of thing. So it was never, I'd never actually... Oh, well, I suppose I had thought, yeah, it could be an answer to housing. It's only that I thought of it since. Like, I really built it just because I enjoy the idea of building a small, demountable house, because I enjoy having it such a luxury, having our own timber from the forest to begin with. And the thing I most enjoy is just to sit on the ground with a chisel and carpenter. And so... you know, it's taken me 2 years just to build that. I'll try and finish it this year. And then what I'll do is I'll move it into the forest, you know, and just to show that it can be moved and see what the problems are of moving it.
What about infrastructure?
Well, you've got infrastructure. It would have a sink and a small gas stove and a food safe and maybe a solar panel and a battery and it'd have enough to do that. But I think of them in terms of community. So you don't have a bathroom or a shower room or anything generally in a thing like that, because you have common facilities. Even in most communities you have a common kitchen, plus you have a personal kitchen normally, and then you have a common bathroom and water facility, and you mean Wi-Fi and
no I mean thinking about moving one into somebody's garden in a large existing community, even though they might not mind having it there, how would one have access to water, for the little sink?
Well, you'd run water to it.
From the other person's supply.
I think
therein lies the problem, sharing their infrastructure.
Well, I'd imagine it'd be a really minimal demand in a small mm-hmm. house like that. You'd think that it would be... and they would interact much more with the centre kitchen than in their own thing. And it's not as if they need water for a garden or anything as well. I mean, that's where a lot of your water goes. It goes into just sort of, all of Julia's water goes into keeping her garden alive, really. She used about a litre a day to make a kombucha.
I had the vision of the idea of a platform on some Oroville land, or not necessarily a platform, but a cleared area where a number of structures like this could be, with Oroville providing infrastructure, a community kitchen, a community shower bathroom business, so that you did each have your separate space, but come together as a community for cooking.
Yeah, eating. Yeah, sort of a camping ground, sort of.
A fancy camping
ground. Yeah, exactly. Patrick and I did have this idea on this field between here and us. There's one field there, and we thought, actually, in the centre, because there were so many people we felt coming by who want low cost. They didn't want to pay a guest house rate,
And what kind of cost are we looking at here? Ballpark for one
per cap per a pod. Well, I don't know. So that's, I was trying to keep it down to a lakh per person. I think if you can keep it to a lakh, because it breaks that whole syndrome of not really knowing what you're going to get and what it's going to cost, and like you found with the price doubles halfway through the process, and you've got to race off and try and find some money somewhere. But it's an attempt to defuse that whole thing we're really stuck in, which is Neo-Egyptian, really. It's an ancient procedure. You see, it seems to me that we could pretty easily come up with what we would consider to be the optimal, the variations for the optimal house for these conditions, and we don't even yet seriously think in terms of natural cooling. We think in terms of how many fans you're going to need, we're still very much building in a traditional European way in a tropical country, and if you look at the way tropical country, like you go into North Africa or somewhere, you'll see that the concern that's gone into, like for instance, in a tropical country, you'd have all your walls would be shaded all the time,
mm-hmm.
So that you never have the sun doesn't hit your walls and the rain doesn't hit your walls, and then in fact you can just have mud,
mm-hmm.
Like this red mud that we have here. If it's kept dry, which is the essential thing in monsoon, mostly dry, and you don't get very much wind-blown rain, and you have large eaves that protect it from wind and rain.
Like a metre and a half, perhaps?
Yeah, yeah, good solid eaves. Like the classic Australian country house in this climate has a veranda, like a 3-metre veranda, all the way around the house. I mean, it's a huge luxury, but it's a wonderful thing. And your living room, I mean, they use one part for storeroom and one part for different things and agricultural implements and sort of thing, like the old traditional farm. But you do have a large... I built one like this, actually, exactly the same as this, up in Freedom, but it has a 3-metre veranda that stretches from here on two sides, and this here opens completely out to it. This middle part just opens out to it. It was only a one-man house for this friend of mine who's subsequently died. But it, in my terms, it's the most beautiful house I've built, because it's just this huge veranda and a huge open veranda. And that means that the air that comes into your house is already cooled.
Mm-hmm.
It's already shaded. And all your walls are shaded and cooled, you know. Mm-hmm. And they don't get wet in monsoon, and they don't... But you've got to put them off the ground to protect them from moisture and from termites, since it's wood and it's mud and it's all sorts of things that are going to attract termites. And, you know, they can be... These walls are only 2 inches thick. They're just as thick as the wood. That's mud and cow dung. And that's, I think, in the nanopod I would put... if, you know, the one that I'm building there, I think I will put mud and cow dung in that one, because I intend to live in that one myself eventually.
What percentage? How far?
Of what?
Mud?
No, no, it's no, it's no, it's 90% mud.
Mm-hmm.
It's mud. The way you do it was Regina who really pioneered that technology. It's red earth. I mean, although you can use this yellow clay as well, it's red earth mixed with coconut fiber.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you see. Well, inside there, you've got split bamboo, and then woven in the split bamboo is this wild date, this ground date, you know, the Kasangay they call it. Then you put a thin layer of mud, just mix up this mud and coconut fibre, which is by the fibre they use for making the rope. You can buy it as a fibre. You put that on, and you put that on actually doing 6 layers. You do 1 layer in the middle, and you do 1 layer on both sides. And then you another layer on both sides. You're doing actually 3 thicknesses. And then, of course, they dry gradually. Then you put... And all the cow dung does is, on the outside, is waterproof. Because cow dung is actually an adhesive.
Mm.
It's a high-protein casein adhesive, really. That's quite impressive. Look at the quality of that. And that's as good as a good adhesive paint. And Julia hasn't even... I mean, this is the third year, and so it doesn't really need it. But I've got a storeroom there that's got cow dung on it that's already 8 years old or something, and I haven't redone the cow dung. I mean, it does shrink a little bit, the mud, and so it wouldn't hurt to re cow dung it now. But we could definitely, if we adopted tropical and we dropped our manic obsession with permanence, you know.
It's a funny thing.
Yeah.
What's permanent?
Have you ever tried to break up a bit of concrete, you know? And concrete, I mean, you know, that was for me the relief of coming here and building with bamboo and keat and those things was just that whole thing of not having to worry about making a mistake, because you just take it apart and put it back together, you know. Mm-hmm. But the mistakes you can make with a bloody block of concrete... Like Krishna had some kids in solitude who came over and built him a bicycle-powered washing machine, but the bloody thing's below ground level, so he can't drain it. So he said, "Would I lift it out and raise it?" And I said, "Digger, this concrete. They got like a half a meter slab of concrete under that thing. It's just not possible to move it. You know, It's just so easy to make concrete, and it's just so difficult to break it up. To biodegrade it. And so, you know, so these houses use as little concrete. It's got a concrete frame, this one has. I mean, the pod has only a steel frame, and has a cylindrical concrete foundation. But, you know, I mean, it just seems to me that these are the materials that are available here. You'd be surprised how much wood that's grown in Oroville has ended up being sold to the village, you know, because we don't use it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. We put ferrocement beams instead of wood beams in most architecture, because they want them geometrically straight and rigid. You know, they don't have to deal with the vagaries of a bent piece of wood sort of thing. But the eucalyptus, you see all that wood there, that's eucalyptus. These are all eucalyptus beams.
Mm-hmm.
That's work tree. That's actually transformation. You know, the transformation tree.
But
these doors are and all that, that's work tree. So this is all just stuff, and we've managed to build, 5 houses or something from our forests for this wood. And look at the wood in the stairs, for instance. Good, big, solid slabs of wood.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I remember, too, Bucky Fuller, wasn't his idea to build with what's there and to blend in with nature rather than sticking out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, well, that was what they called organic architecture. Very much in the see, the pioneer of that really was Frank Lloyd Wright, wasn't it, in America? And it's true that the architectural school of thought that I was brought up with, so to speak, was to almost be as invisible as you possibly can, to
make no footprint.
Yeah. Well, yeah, his architecture, he developed an architecture which lay in the landscape, you know, and it it used very natural and earth materials all the time. It never, you know, when you look at, for instance, this whole Frank Gehry, for instance, attitude where you, I don't know if you know him, but this is the contemporary architecture. It's very glamorous and, you know, it's trying to be noticed sort of thing. There's some hellishly horrible contemporary architecture in my terms. I mean, architecture, it's like music, you know. You had this incredible spirit in the 1960s behind you, the music and the whole endeavor that seemed to get lost in a world of plastic and. But it's coming back, you know, slowly coming back. You can see it's like a wave, isn't it? It comes back as a. And the thing is that it's practicable. You know, the closer you get to these materials and the closer you get to you know, fitting into your environment, and it's just the whole thing of living on solar panels and, you know, composting toilets and windmills and all those things. You feel in the end like another leaf in the wind, you know, like you feel as if you depend so much on the vagaries of nature. It reminds me very much of sailing, you know, when you're at sea, you're subject to the, you know, we've got this feeling that we can totally dominate the environment, whereas, you know, in fact we're the victor, what the object of it.
Yeah, but trying to change it, control it, instead of working with it, living with it.
Yeah.
So nanopod.
No, that was really Krishnamaya who leapt on that name. You know Krishnamaya from Arca?
Yes, Krishnan, yeah.
And I'd known him because he used to come up sometimes on Sundays and work here. But he got me over to put a roof on top of Arca recently. They want to put a vaulted. First, he wanted a dome, and it, you know, it was ridiculous. But we ended up putting a vaulted. We haven't done it yet, but we've done a big model and stuff with. He discovered the demountable house. You know, what's this? What's going on? And so I told him what it was. He's, this is it. And he seriously talks of, because he came to the housing thing. He's trying to break into housing. He came to the housing group people with his idea of hollow blocks, didn't he? I mean, hollow blocks, I wouldn't have thought was... No, it's not a bad idea. When the hollow block was first invented, it was hailed as a great... You know, I built a hollow block, but Frederick was manufacturing hollow blocks in the 80s in Oroville. Frederick and a guy named Tim Maurice, they started... And I actually designed and built a building in... The main building in Ummi is some hollow blocks. And the thing is, the problem with hollow blocks is that because they're hollow and concrete slabs do crack, termites get inside your hollow blocks, and they're perfect channels for termites to get up in the thing. They're cool if you can guarantee that they're termite-free. It's a lightweight concrete that does convey moisture into the house, you know. And so, I don't know, I think it was an idea that was used for about 5 years in Oroville and then dropped for numerous reasons. And so I think when Krishnan wanted to reinvent it, so to speak, he wanted to bring down the technology, and he just wanted to be, he's an industrialist, really, and he keeps telling all the things he's industrialized, you know. He said he came up first day and I was making doses, and he said, I invented a machine that makes 20 doses in a minute. Great big arm. He's that sort of a guy, and I like him. He's got a sort of his heart in the right place, really. Mm-hmm. And then, like I say, he's come by with a structural engineer to look at it. He's come by with all sorts of people all the time. for a while, he's coming by every day. And there's been it's sort of flavour of the month at the moment, this house, because like Richard, I don't know if you know Richard, who's Claire's mother's brother, Richard is Claire's uncle. He came by on Monday with Arumugan from the housing, the cycle shed, cycle, the puncture service,
mm-hmm.
because they need a small unit for a watchman or somebody to live in their place and just be there at night, you know. Mm-hmm. They just want a small, which they could possibly move, and it's ideal, really. But they want it now, you know, you can now have it, sort of thing, and they would take it and now if I could sell it to them. But so, you know, so then either Krishnamaya gets together to manufacture. Aluk did the same thing. Aluk, you know, he's also interested in manufacturing them, but he does his cashews and his tea and his different things. He's a wonderful character, Aluk. And Aluk actually even took the design and reproduced it in smaller bits of steel and stuff on the ground and thing over in his place, but I haven't actually seen it, but he calls it the Johnny House. It's a, you know, it's a self-supporting, movable, mosquito-proof, dust-proof, possibly solar-powered, single or double-person living unit. But I think that, you know, I think if we could defuse the thing of permanence, then people are less freaked out by the possibility of somebody, you know, maybe leaving their place and for a short period, and then, you know, and you know, all the time they're ideal. You know, they're not necessarily the answer to Oriville's housing problem, but they're ideal for students who are on the increase. Like Paul says, he's got capsules in the botanical gardens, you know, and he needs something. And even the when you're renewing a capsule's costing you $20,000 or something now to build. You're re-kitting it and re-repairing it every sort of 3 or 4 years. It's costing you another $10,000. So they're just becoming, and he's saying, well, why not put something that's a bigger investment in the beginning that also gives them a little kitchen, which makes them a bit more independent. And it's a, you know, and they're students who've got a laptop, and they're, you know, they want to, and they've sort of, and it doesn't, you know, where do you put your laptop in a capsule sort of thing? It's okay for a comic book, but it's... And so he was saying if I was a manufacturer, he'd take four, you know, and sort of thing. So I could see that if this was a viable unit, and you could, people, you know, if we had a production unit, you could definitely have no... You could even export them, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Export a demountable house.